content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we will start today with The Hard-Won Lessons of Lilith Fair. This was written by Sophie Gilbert. One of the cruelest tricks played on the North American women's movement is the way the caricatures, over time, have edged out reality. The ritualized bra burnings never happened. The batik hemp dresses, not since the 1970s. The strictly enforced misandry, only on holidays. With regard to the Lilith Fair, the late 90s touring festival of female artists, co-founded by Sarah McLachlan, so many jokes were made about bi-level haircuts and juice tents and lesbopalooza that the purpose and power of Lilith have largely been relegated to the archives. I just recently discovered there was an all-female music festival from 1997 to 1999, and I am shook to my core, a young woman exclaimed on TikTok 2 years ago, prompting consternation from millennial and Gen X elders at the loss of some of our crucial cultural history. All of which makes Lilith Fair Building a Mystery, a new Hulu documentary from the director and writer Ali Pankew, particularly relevant, both as a corrective to the mocking mythology of Lilith and as a distillation of what women have lost in the decades since. As a 14-year-old in 1997, who stayed up late to tape Paula Cole and Sean Colvin songs off the one British radio program that sometimes played them, I was probably fated to cry all the way through Lilith Fair, and indeed I did. More than the music, or the melancholic nostalgia, though, what felt devastating was the realization of how rare the festival's sense of collective possibility feels today. Being there was one of the earliest memories I've had of safety, the actor Dan Levy, a producer on the film, tells the camera, looking around at the crowds and seeing people smiling and celebrating and being fully themselves felt like this kind of quiet revolution. The concept for Lilith, as McLachlan and her co-founders, her agent, manager, and road manager at the time, make clear, was less ideological than pragmatic. By 1996, McLachlan had released several albums, with 1993's thoughtful, moody, fumbling toward ecstasy marking a breakthrough. But she kept encountering obstacles from the industry, which, despite a new wave of new performers in rock, hip-hop, and indie, saw female artists as tokens at best. Radio stations, interviewees in the documentary explain, refused to play two songs by women in a row. Promoters wouldn't put two women back-to-back on the same bill for fear of looking like they were hosting Ladies' Night, or the less charmingly titled Pussy Package. The women who did succeed, as Liz Fair notes, were pitted against one another or publicly dragged by TV and radio hosts for not looking sexy enough. At 19, Jewel recalls she was asked, "How do you give a blowjob with those teeth?" Fair was asked to pose for a magazine wearing nothing but men's pants and suspenders. "Everything that I was good at, that I was skilled at, that I had worked my entire life for, boiled down to, do her tits look good," she says. McLachlan, lonely on the road, was disenfranchised after her new American label suggested that she fix her hair and lose 5 pounds. Had the idea to tour with some other women, partly to prove the promoters wrong, and partly out of desire to have more women in her life. Her co-founders were all men, and all three were instrumental in helping to establish Lilith. Touring festivals at the time were popular, lucrative, and impossibly male. Lollapalooza's 1996 Los Angeles lineup featured more martial arts performing monks than it did women. McLaughlin suggested a tour in which she shared billing with other female artists, doing a test run of sold-out shows with Paula Cole, Patti Smith, Lisa Loeb, and Amy Mann in 1996. Selling people on the concept wasn't easy. "I know that if it's a good idea," Loeb describes herself thinking when she was invited to join the tour. Or she said, "I don't know if that's a good idea." Having fought for much of their career to be seen as artists, not women artists, many were reluctant to silo themselves intentionally. But from the onset, Lilith felt different to its performance, to its performers. The festival was named after a figure from Jewish folklore, Adam's first wife, who left the Garden of Eden because he refused to treat her as an equal. It was a demonstration not of secondary status, but of strength. The first show at the Gorge Amphitheater in Washington State drew 15,000 people. The bulk of the next 36 shows sold out. There were female crew members, engineers, sound technicians, an incubation of female talent, as Catherine Runnels, the production coordinator, puts it. And the crew had extended health care plans, which for many was unprecedented. Dan Frazier, McLaughlin's former road manager and one of Lilith's co-founders, recounts how these grown men would be crying because they could send their kids to the dentist. The artists, more than accustomed to the isolation of touring, quickly formed a community, practicing harmonies backstage for each show's closing sing-along. "Whoa, is this heaven?" Emmy Lou Harris remembers thinking. "I think Lilith there is a symbol of hope," Paula Cole says in an archival interview from before her set one day. "Not only is there a tremendous amount of support, but I think this is just a metaphor for what could be in other areas of life." Lilith Fair is partly adapted from an excellent 2019 Vanity Fair oral history of the festival by Jessica Hopper, Sasha Geffen, and Jen Pelly, but the documentary has the benefit of being able to draw on raw footage of Lilith's prize asset, its audience. "One of the things I was criticized the most for in my music was sincerity, which was kind of funny," Joel explains over footage of her performing the painfully vulnerable "Near You Always" at the Gorge. "But I have to say that when I sang for Lilith, what I noticed in the audience was unabashed sincerity." Pankew cuts to scenes of young women watching and smiling with the unself-conscious radiance of oil-painted saints. But there were also plenty of men in the audience, and attendees wear not just tie-dye, but also Adidas and Gold's Gym t-shirts. The idea propagated by Saturday Night Live skits and sitcom one-liners about that Lilith Fair was a misandrist showcase for joyless hormonal angst was totally alien to the accounts of what being there was actually like. Lilith's success spawned a backlash, which was inevitable, and the whiteness of its 1997 lineup led to valid criticism of its lack of inclusivity. In the Vanity Fair oral history, McLaughlin argues that this wasn't due to a lack of trying to book a more diverse slate of artists. Many people she'd asked to join turned her down. In the festival's second and third years, it was easier to sell people on what Lilith represented. Not just a community and a more nurturing touring environment, but an alliance. The music industry had doubted that women could have meaningful commercial clout, and Lilith Fair proved them wrong. Erica Badu notes that Lilith inspired her to establish the touring Sugar Water Festival in 2005. It demonstrated the collective potency of women as artists and as leaders. We are businesswomen, Sheryl Crow remembers realizing during the tour. We are women who run our tours. We are women who make the creative decisions. We are women that set the tone for how everything gets treated on the road. Watching from the perspective of 2025 is a discombobulating experience. Women have come to dominate popular music in the years since. The Eras and Cowboy Carter tours are maybe the only recent cultural phenomena to have conjured a similar camaraderie and delight as Lilith Fair. But they don't tend to project as much of a shared sense of community or political intention. A 2010 attempt to revive the festival failed because, as music critic Ann Powers theorized, on the one hand, there are many, many more visible women at the top of the mainstream pop scene. On the other hand, I think it's arguable that there's less consciousness. The earnestness and sincerity that characterized so much of the music from the late 90s were overtaken by the sneering rage of nu metal. Take your Birkenstocks and stick them, Limp Bizkit's Fred Durst screams in footage from Woodstock 99, where women reported being harassed, groped, and sexually assaulted. Today, the prevailing modes of popular culture are detached self-awareness and winking irony, defensive attitudes that hint at a feeling of helplessness, that nothing one does will really make a difference. McLaughlin says she has no interest in bringing back Lilith Fair, possibly because the 2010 failure was so bruising, but also because she clearly sees it as a group effort that someone else would need to steward to make it both relevant and significant in the 2020s. But it's hard watching Lilith Fair not to yearn for some of what the festival conjured at the end of the 20th century, a sense of shared strength and communal agency. These women can sell tickets, and we proved that, Marty Diamond, McLaughlin's former agent and Lilith co-founder, says at the end of the documentary. But what the festival was really about, he argues, was the power of music, the power of women, and the power of purpose. But nothing lasts forever. Next, The Judaism I Thought I Knew by Sarah Hurwitz. This article has been adapted from Hurwitz's new book, As a Jew, Reclaiming Our Story from Those Who Blame, Shame, and Try to Erase Us. Tomorrow night, along with Jews across America and around the world, I'll be heading to my synagogue to begin observing Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. For most of my life, I attended reluctantly, dreading the long hours of prayer. I was proud to be Jewish, taking satisfaction in my people's survival and success, despite the attempts to annihilate us. But I was also embarrassed by what I perceived as Judaism's weirdness and obsolescence. All those nitpicky laws and that implausible reward and punishment God, I thought, was portrayed in the liturgy. I'm just a cultural Jew, I would tell people, though I knew nothing about Jewish culture, history, language, arts, or philosophy. I more meant that I liked edgy humor and bought too much food for dinner parties. Or I'd say that I was an ethnic Jew, not realizing that there are Jews of just about every ethnicity, and every race, too. Sometimes I proclaimed that my social justice is my Judaism, without any idea what Jewish tradition says about social justice. I think I mainly wanted to assure people that I wasn't one of those Jews who follow all those laws, though I had never met any of those Jews or bothered to learn about any of those laws. As far as I knew, Judaism consisted of little more than a handful of holidays, some universal values, help the vulnerable, don't lie, and the Holocaust. Then about a decade ago, I started studying Jewish tradition. What I found was nothing like the Judaism I had known, and it turned out to be an answer to the question that I and many others would be asking years later about how to be a Jew in a time of rising anti-Semitism. I had always thought that Judaism had a particular creed, one that required me to have faith in a certain kind of God, but I discovered an astonishing range of conceptions of God and plenty of Jewish atheists. I learned that Jewish texts are not books of dogma. In Judaism's most sacred text, the Torah, humans argue with God and even change God's mind. And the 2-million-word commentary known as the Talmud, which forms the basis of Jewish law, is a collection of vigorous debates among ancient rabbis. In Jewish tradition, the process of probing, questioning, and analyzing is not separate from spirituality. It is spirituality. I had bought the old line that Christianity is a religion of love, and Judaism is a religion of law, enforced by an angry Old Testament God. But if I had paid even the slightest attention to the prayers we recited in synagogue, I would have noticed many declarations of God's love for us. As I studied Jewish law about how we should speak, care for our body, cope with change, conduct our professional life, and treat others, I found it to be far wiser and far humane than much of what passes for wisdom today. How had I so badly misunderstood my own tradition, and why had I been exposed to so little of it? I knew what Catholicism says about abortion and contraception, but not what Judaism says about them. I knew what various politicians thought about issues such as poverty and criminal justice, but I knew nothing about the Jewish thinking on these matters, or that there even was Jewish thinking. For so many years, my Jewish identity had consisted of a series of caveats and apologies, amounting to little more than a cross between an ethnic joke and some statements about social justice with which any priest, minister, imam, and decent secular person would agree. One major reason for my ignorance, I came to learn, dates back 2,000 years to the founding of Christianity, when many early church leaders defined their religion in opposition to Judaism. They insisted that God had forsaken the Jews and that Christians had taken their place as the chosen people, an idea known as replacement theology or supersessionism. The condemned Jewish text and traditions and the Jews themselves as materialistic, legalistic, spiritually dead, even evil, they condemned these texts and traditions. Centuries later, medieval church leaders censored the Talmud and ordered it burned. In the 19th century, my ancestors in Western Europe, seeking to assimilate while remaining Jewish, began de-emphasizing aspects of Judaism that their fellow citizens disdained. They downplayed the Talmud and put greater weight on the biblical texts they shared with Christians. They made their synagogues look like churches, installing organs and pews, and ditched rituals that were considered uncivilized, such as blowing the shofar, a ram's horn, and breaking a glass at weddings. I had once thought my cultural, ethnic, social justice Jewish identity was empowering, the result of charting my own path as a modern Jew. But as I studied my ancestors, I began to understand how warped it had been by hatred and lies, and by the language of the Christian majority culture in which I had been raised, one filled with words and conceptions that not only fail to accommodate Judaism's truths, but also distort and demean them. In recent decades, major Christian denominations have renounced their historic anti-Judaism, yet the legacy lingers. My former Jewish identity was, in many ways, the product of 2,000 years of anti-Semitism and 200 years of efforts by Jews to erase parts of ourselves and our tradition in the vain hope of being accepted and safe. Now the ancient scourge of anti-Semitism is once again flaring up, and American Jews are understandably focused on combating it. But it's hard to fight Jew hatred when you don't really know what being a Jew means. Back when I knew nothing about Jewish tradition and history, I wouldn't have known how to respond. to someone who said the Jewish God is violent and vengeful, or that Israel is a colonialist endeavor. I had little to offer beyond Seinfeld and Tikkun Olam. Once I knew the Jewish story, however, I was no longer intimidated by such accusations. Trying to fight anti-Semitism can be like fighting a tsunami with a bucket. It may be time for Jews to devote more of our efforts to building an ark, reclaiming the parts of our tradition that we have lost, and building stronger Jewish communities that will help us not just withstand hatred, but live deeper, worthier, and more truly Jewish lives. Today's third story, The Myth of the Campus Snowflake, by Christopher L. Eisgruber. A few weeks ago, I welcomed Princeton's newly arrived undergraduates to campus with what has become an annual tradition, a presidential lecture on the importance of free speech and civil discussion. This semester, I will host small seminars with first-year and transfer students to impress upon them my view that free speech is essential to the research and teaching mission of American universities. Some people might expect my advocacy for robust debate to get a hostile reception. Cultural critics of a certain age love to describe the current generation of college students as fragile, steeped in cancel culture, and reluctant to confront opposing ideas. My own experience, however, is largely the opposite. As I observe in my new book, Terms of Respect, most of the students with whom I talk are committed to constructive discussions and eager to encounter views different from their own. Even the horrific events in Utah earlier this month illustrate the point. Thousands of students at Utah Valley University had gathered to hear Charlie Kirk speak and debate audience members before he was killed by an assassin with no apparent connection to the school. What accounts for the gap between public perception and on-campus reality? Part of the answer is that several cases of genuinely closed-minded student behavior have attracted disproportionate and long-running attention. These include the attack on the political scientists Charles Murray and Allison Stanger at Middlebury College in 2017, the heckling of Judge Kyle Duncan at Stanford Law School in 2023, and such incidents are inexcusable. Colleges must discipline the students responsible when such episodes occur, but there are millions of lectures, classes, art exhibitions, and other events on American college campuses every year. Disruptions are rare, which is why so the few outrageous events get regurgitated so often in stories. A related problem is that lists and databases of student misbehavior lump genuine disruptions together with other kinds of oppositional activity, such as protests and requests that the university denounce an offensive speaker. Protesting a speaker or criticizing an invitation is, however, itself an exercise of free speech, not an infringement upon it. A campus with a lot of protest may have an excellent free speech climate. Confusion about this point inflects the free speech rankings that the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression publishes periodically. In 2023, FIRE ranked Michigan Technological University as the best school in the country for free speech. FIRE's Director of Polling and Analytics, Sean Stevens, told the New York Post that it made sense that a technological school has a better speech climate, primarily for the reason that they don't really talk as much about controversial topics. In fact, the failure to talk about controversial topics is not a free speech success story. It's a free speech disaster. Stevens' mistake is telling. Free speech rankings too often code controversy as censorship and silence as freedom. When disruptions do occur, students and colleges sometimes get tarred by the behavior of outsiders. At Princeton, we experienced a series of disruptions to speeches last spring. The worst of them occurred when somebody pulled a fire alarm to cut short an event featuring former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. We did not catch the person who triggered the alarm, But we did identify several people who violated university rules at the Bennett event. None of those people were members of the Princeton community. Critics of universities might counter that even if true episodes of campus censorship are rare, what matters is that students are afraid to express themselves. In making that claim, however, they rely on poorly constructed polls, typically produced by advocacy groups, that paint a misleading, dismal picture of student attitudes towards free speech. Media industry incentives also inflate the public's perception of campus censoriousness. Websites including Campus Reform and The College Fix peddle a steady stream of anecdotes that feed the fury of an audience already disposed to be angry with left-wing professors and students. Some of those articles work their way up the food chain to mainstream media outlets. Stories about intolerant students get clicks and eyeballs. I do not mean to suggest that today's campus culture always creates a free speech nirvana. Students and faculty can sometimes be intolerant. Then again, so can most American adults. When controversial speakers appear on the Princeton campus, I almost always get more complaints and disinvitation demands from outsiders than I do from Princeton students. Students have told me that the biggest free speech problem on campus today is self-censorship in deference to peer pressure. Their assessment coincides with the conclusions of some of the best social science work on the topic, such as the excellent study at the University of North Carolina system campuses by the political scientist Timothy Ryan and his colleagues. Self-censorship is a problem on campuses, not because of some problem special to young people or colleges, but because self-censorship is a problem in America. I write this knowing that a small group of students could behave intolerantly tomorrow on or on any day, any other day. They might embarrass me and my university. Protesters can say outrageous things, including about me. Yet I also know that students today, like their predecessors, can and often do inspire me with their efforts to hold our country to its highest ideals. We should recognize and respect their commitment to our constitutional values and welcome their voices to the conversation. They are needed. The author of this article is the president of Princeton University and the author of Terms of Respect, How Colleges Get Free Speech Right. This last article was edited slightly due to time constraints, because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.